Welcome to Whistleblower Network News. I am your host, Jane Turner, FBI whistleblower and advocate. It is our honor to share with you these experiences of real-life heroes and people of integrity. Welcome. This is Jane Turner, FBI whistleblower and whistleblower advocate. And today on Whistleblower of the Week, we have quite the honor hosting acclaimed academic Dr. Joan Donovan, who has devoted her research to exploring modes of media manipulation and its cultural, structural, and societal impacts. Currently an assistant professor of journalism and emerging media studies in the College of Communications at Boston University, Dr. Donovan founded the Critical Internet Studies Institute and is the former director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard's Kennedy Shorenstein Center. At Shorenstein Center, Dr. Donovan directed the Technology and Social Change Research Project, conducting research, developing methods, and facilitating workshops for journalists, policymakers, technologists, and civil society organizations on how to detect, document, and debunk media manipulation campaigns. Dr. Donovan has raised millions in grants, testified before Congress, and has been a frequent commentator on television, often faulting internet companies for profiting from the spread of divisive falsehood. Her work is all about holding big tech companies like Meta accountable for issues ranging from disinformation, teen mental health, and war and political propaganda. After the leak of the Facebook papers in 2021 and Frances Haugen's testimony to Congress, Dr. Donovan set to make the documents publicly available in a database. As the project launched, she began losing her academic freedom as restrictions to her research increased. Dr. Donovan submitted a complaint to Harvard, the U.S. Secretary of Education, and the Massachusetts Attorney General on January 15th, alleging Harvard officials of taking cues and acting on behalf of Meta's best interest while questioning her research methodologies specifically regarding Facebook. She claims that the university began restricting her research after the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative donated $500 million to fund a new university-wide center on artificial intelligence. Harvard and the Chan Zuckerberg Foundation strongly dispute Dr. Donovan's claims. Welcome, Dr. Donovan. You are a towering figure. And thank you for battling for the rest of us in regards to this whole area of disinformation. And you right now are speaking truth to power. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jane. It's really great to be here in your company.
Excellent. Walk us through, Doctor, the timeline of your career and research projects at Harvard and the imposition of restrictions that they placed on you.
Yeah, so I've been, throughout my life, very interested in issues related to social movements, communication, did my dissertation research at University of California, San Diego, on the rise of networked social movements, particularly the Occupy movement. And so years later, as I watched the rise of the alt-right and was doing research about white supremacists and DNA ancestry testing online, I had a kind of front row seat to the organizing of disinformation campaigns as they rose in the 2016 elections, even though I wasn't necessarily researching politics at the time. And from that work, I was recruited over to Data and Society Research Institute, New York, to conduct research on media manipulation, disinformation. And I worked with a very smart team, mostly of young women who were interested in these same kinds of big picture questions about tech. So by the time I get to Harvard, there's a nascent field emerging around media manipulation and disinformation. And there are some really great scholars who are toiling away at understanding bad actors online. As I'm at Harvard and I'm looking around and I'm trying to understand what's happening, it dawns on me as we're doing the research that maybe there's something else going on here. It is now my view that disinformation and media manipulation campaigns are as much a product of Meta or X or Twitter at the time or YouTube as are any other genre of content. And really, it's bad product design and lack of oversight and lack of enforcement within these companies that gives bad actors the actual capacity to reach millions of people with grifts, scams, hoaxes, fakes. And as I was doing my research in the field, I also noted that different companies had different angles on how they would enroll university researchers into their work stream. So in some instances, you might have a company that will fund research and they're not necessarily interested in the outcomes. But what became pervasive as I was working at Harvard and the field was growing is that Meta was pouring more and more money into research about itself. But we're picking winners and losers in terms of who had access to funding to do their studies, as well as what kind of data they were able to utilize. This is different from Twitter, that wasn't giving out necessarily large research grants, but had opened up their API, that is access to the data for academics for free. And so academics who wanted data from Facebook had a really difficult time getting it. And what we saw in our field is that if someone did come up with or understand one of these products and its harmful effects, you would be not just up against your own field in terms of proving your findings, you'd be up against the corporation's PR machine in terms of getting them, well, essentially, they would never admit any wrongdoing on their own part, but they would attack researchers very publicly. And I've seen researchers, you know, throw their arms up in the air saying, what are we supposed to do? Which is why when Frances Haugen became a whistleblower and took those documents from Facebook, and when I saw these documents, I realized these companies know what we know. And not only are they fighting us in the press, not only are they fighting against us, but they're also fighting a very inside strategy of trying to co-opt research and turn researchers into a wing of their PR. And so I, as a researcher, have dedicated my research time and energy to looking at those product designs and of making sense of digital harms. And unfortunately, when I did get my hands on, lawfully, the catch of Haugen documents, and I stated my intention to my own dean that I was going to make these documents available to the public, it was slowly that I started to understand the depth of Meta's connections to Harvard, and that my own research, as long as I focused on the bad guys or I focused on other companies, I was fine. But anytime I started to look more in depthly at Meta, especially at Harvard, there was a major problem. And I'll just sum it up as saying that later we found out, or I found out, that it wasn't just that Meta were alumni, Meta executives were alumni of Harvard. They were also close personal friends with my own dean, who 4 days before letting me go attended Sheryl Sandberg's wedding and was photographed in People magazine of all places. And it just made me think that no matter what you do in academia, you know, I had a fully funded research program. I was the golden goose at Harvard in the sense that very few qualitative research programs raise the kind of money and profile that I do. But that I wasn't going to be permitted to do research about Meta at Harvard, and that I was going to be questioned for it. And after that, what it led to was a sort of death by a thousand paper cuts. There was more and more bureaucracy added into decisions that needed to be made. I was put on a hiring freeze. I wasn't able to spend my budgets on any kind of public facing outputs like a podcast. And I thought that this was a really big scandal, not just because my own interpersonal involvement, but because what the institution of education and what universities are here to do is tell these uncomfortable truths and to make sense of a disorganized and chaotic world. And I started to realize more and more as I was at Harvard that there are a lot of people within Harvard that are content to maintain the status quo. It's the only place in the world where I've worked that university administrators and other faculty members are also millionaires. And you start to realize that there is a lot going on at this university in terms of backroom deals, in terms of corruption, and that I'm just another story among many within that storied institution that should be rooted out and investigated.
Excellent. So, Doctor, this is critical research that you're conducting, because this whole issue of disinformation is just critically important in today's world. I mean, this is so important what you're doing. When did you sense things were starting to change there at Harvard? What was it connected to your work and the university's connections with Meta? When did you start noticing that they were breathing down your neck on your research?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it was a very abrupt change. I had been selected by the dean to speak to a group called the Dean's Council, which is a group of donors, people that have spent a lot of their money to make large donations to the Kennedy School. And so it was a Zoom call in October of 2021. Where I was on the call, and there were about, I don't remember how many, but a couple dozen donors. So you can imagine the Zoom windows open, and there's, you know, many boxes of people. Some people are getting their hair done, other people are eating breakfast. And me and my supervisor are asked to have a dialogue about disinformation and democracy. And it's on that call that we first start talking about the Haugen disclosures that had also come out that month. And she had recently testified in front of Congress. And so it was top line news at the moment. And mm-hmm. my colleague asked me what I thought about the documents. And I said on that call that I've seen them, that I have them. I have them in my possession, and I'm concerned that these are some of the most important documents in the history of the internet, and that that Meta knew all along what much of our research knew about how their products cause harm. And it was at that moment that a Meta executive who was also on the call, who had been the former head of PR and held a few different positions at Meta over his years, he was angry. And so he started waving his arms and trying to turn his microphone on. He wanted to interrupt the presentation, which he couldn't do because of everybody was muted. But the moderator interrupted to say that there will be questions afterwards. And we moved on in the conversation, about 10 minutes discussing these documents, and we moved on to discuss other things. But the moment of the Q&A was very embarrassing because he was given the first question. He started rattling off obvious talking points from Meta. You know, how do we even know what misinformation is? There's no real way to understand disinformation. The arbiters of truth line about Facebook isn't the arbiter of truth and that it's here to connect people and that these documents are just internal research, nothing to worry about. And I sat there and I looked at the faces of the people on the call, particularly the faces of the people that should have been defending me. And they were freaked out, including the dean. And so eventually another person chimes in, the moderator, to say that this line of questioning is not appropriate and that the work that I do is sound. And it was less than a week later, I got an email, or about a week later, I got an email from the dean asking me these very same questions that could have been written by Meta themselves about my research. Now, on that call and in my research, I talk about YouTube and Gab and 4chan and all of these other platforms. I study a media ecosystem. I don't just study one platform. And at that time, when the dean had started asking me about Meta and my research about Meta, on what basis I'm making public comments about Meta, the dean also knew of our plans to make an archive of these Facebook documents. Legally, Frances Haugen is only able to provide those documents to Congress and law enforcement. So I received the documents not from her, but separately. And the plan was to work with colleagues at Harvard to build a collaborative archive that people, researchers and journalists from all over the world could utilize and annotate and add links to and add context to in order to understand these documents and understand what was happening internally at Facebook. And that entire work plan was undermined over the next year as I struggled to do even basic things like hire an events coordinator.
So you spoke truth to power. You're talking about your research and the retaliation sounds like it started almost right away. Or was there a period of time, or right from the start, boom, they started chipping away at you, which is very typical with whistleblowers.
Yeah, it really was very, very quick. And unfortunately, in November, right after the dean had essentially called me into the principal's office, he wanted to have a meeting about my research quickly. He wanted to involve all of the other deans at the school. It was a pretty hot moment. And I got COVID and was hospitalized for nearly a month. I was out for 2 months on disability. So that meeting only was able to happen in January. It was literally the first thing that I did when I got back to the university. And in that meeting, it felt a lot like a dissertation defense. They didn't want me to use slides, but they wanted me to justify the entire basis of the field that I work in, and justify the research projects that I had selected. And it just felt to me like I was being set up to fail. And from that moment forward, it became very difficult for me to hire. It became difficult for me to coordinate events. Everything was very slow. Anywhere in the bureaucracy that I needed a decision to be made, it was deflect or delay. And that went on for a couple of months. And I realized more and more that I was being pushed out, in that potentially I don't want to say a smarter person, but like a more cultured person might see these signs. I'm kind of low class and from Massachusetts. I don't always know when to leave the party. But you know, talking to more of my senior colleagues that have been through it, at different universities, when the bureaucracy locks, that's your sign that you are going no further. And even though I had a contract through December 31st, 2024, and I had at that point $5 or so million in the bank at Harvard already, I was being wound down. So in August of 2022 is when the dean finally told me that he's winding me down and that he's not going to approve any expenditure that increases my public profile, which to me is a really big loss to the public, because I'm one person, but I was at the height at Shorenstein, I employed 40 people. We were more than half the center, and we were doing really great research that was getting a lot of uptake by key stakeholders, policymakers, congressmen. We were, training journalists. We really had a really important and positive public impact and momentum about our research. And in August of 2022, when he said that, it was devastating, because I knew what it implied, which was essentially that we were going to go no further. He also told me that I don't have academic freedom. I don't know anyone that goes to work at a university and does research that doesn't suppose that the university will be protecting their academic freedom. And I thought in my head, okay, what he's telling me is, if I were to proceed with publishing these papers, these documents for Meta, he would allow me to become personally liable. He wouldn't use the university research to defend me. And I thought a lot about that. I thought a lot about my team and how I employ a lot of junior researchers who are not financially stable. You know, I didn't think we would withstand that kind of assault, given that Meta has plenty of money to waste. I mean, and but importantly, I think before all of that happened, after that October meeting in 2021, it became blatantly clear that I was being pushed out, because Chan Zuckerberg in December, so while I was out sick with COVID, gave the university $500 million to start an AI center. And that money doesn't come in all at once. It's a 15-year endowment. So Meta really bought 15 years of influence at Harvard. And I, you know, in thinking about that, I realized, yeah, I'm kind of pushing the boulder uphill, hoping it doesn't roll back. It was unfortunate, because at that point I had so much funding in Harvard that it was really hard to imagine a situation where I would walk away from the funding. But there was no full faith effort to support me while I was there. And that was what was unfortunate to me about the way it all wrapped up, is that I didn't take the sign that I was being kicked out. And so it took them about a year to terminate my contract. They took away my research funding and wouldn't allow me to use it, my budgets. And successively over time, they also restricted me from even at one point speaking about what was happening to me. And I thought, wow, they really want this to go away quietly. And And in many respects, I felt that if I did go away quietly, I would be complicit in what I'm now calling grand theft academia. There's still, I believe, $3 million of my money at Harvard, but they wouldn't give me any budgets or expenditures or anything related to my research endeavor for the last year of my time there. So I can't be sure how they were spending the money or what they were putting it towards. But I do know that I had enough money to last at a $3 million per year burn rate through the end of my contract in December 2024.
Welcome to the world of whistleblowing. I mean, mobbing.
Isn't it the worst, though?
It's the worst.
It is, because your colleagues turn on you.
Yes, everyone
people
does.
Read you.
Mobbing, just, isolation. Yeah. It's really, really terrible. But, you know, Doctor, I wanted to ask you a question here, because our listeners really would like to know this, but I've written stories and we've had whistleblowers that were involved in the media, and they have horrific stories on what's going on there. I mean, really horrific stories. Some of these huge media organizations listening in, if you have one of their pieces of equipment, algorithms that are really evil in some aspects. So I have no doubt that what you're saying is right on, but maybe you could give us a flavor or a feel for what was in the Facebook papers that caused so much consternation and panic over the fact you might reveal or open them up. Could you share with us what was in
those
papers? Yeah,
so some of the things have been covered in extensive journalism by the Wall Street Journal. There's a new book out by Jeff Horowitz, who is also involved in covering Francis Haugen's whistleblowing. But what you learn is that, in particular, when it comes to, say, teen mental health, they knew that Instagram as a product was a problem and that was impacting young teen girls, especially, who were feeling much worse about their body image because of the way that there was so much access to these flawless pictures due to the filtering and aspects, and that in their explore feed. So these are when you're looking at what Meta is recommending to you rather than what it is that you're searching for. You see a lot of content that is somewhat aspirational, but is also unachievable for teens. And so there had been some independent research about Instagram in the past, but nothing that really confirmed so deeply and darkly what was happening on that platform. For instance, you know, there was also a whistleblower very recently, Arturo Bejar, who had been part of the product design team at Instagram, talking about how many teenagers experience unwanted sexual advances because adults can easily message young people on the platforms. And there is going to be a congressional hearing about protecting teens online or protecting children online in January 2024. But nevertheless, the other things that Facebook was very afraid of was really just creating a long tail of crisis in PR for their products. So you even have, at that same time, Facebook becomes deprecated as the name of the company, and the company changes its name to Meta, so that it becomes less affiliated with the Facebook brand. But what we could tell even from the Facebook brand is that they knew that their algorithms were leading people into conspiracy rabbit holes, and that they played some role in incitement of groups of people who met on Facebook and then used Facebook to organize for events like January 6th. Mm-hmm. And so Facebook knew all along that there were problems with the design of their products and the lack of oversight and enforcement of their products. And I think also another key dimension here is also the cross-check list, which was a list of celebrities and politicians and high-networked individuals that didn't have to follow the same terms of service as everybody else. They got a pass because they were a public figure.
So tell me what that means, Dr. Donovan. What do you mean they got a pass?
Yeah, so if you're a public figure or politician, say, for instance, Trump, and you're posting election disinformation up until January 6th, they would allow him to keep his account. And there had been other instances of celebrities using the app to target and harass people or others that they don't like, doxing, et cetera, which made it so that normally Meta would ding those accounts and either flag them or not recommend them or even remove the account entirely. But because these were celebrities or public figures, they worried about their brand management and the reputation of their brand before the safety of the public. And I think that that's what's at stake here, too, is that in some ways, what Meta has built with Facebook and Instagram, these are technologies designed specifically to deliver advertising. And consumers like you and me, we can post our, you know, images, our birthday parties and whatnot. But really how they make money is using the same infrastructure to ensure that you see certain posts that their advertisers provide. And what we've known for years about the products of Meta and Facebook is that advertising is also another conduit in which illegitimate accounts can gain traction. That is, they can gain followers, or they can use advertising to reach audiences that they wouldn't organically be introduced to. And so in many ways, the technology itself, when you really boil it down, what it is it's advertising technology that the rest of us are empowered to use so that there's an audience for those advertisements. And ultimately, I think the way that these platforms should be dealt with then is they should be regulated like broadcast and like other technology or other organizations that have that broadcast feature and do make their money through advertising.
Hi, we'll be right back with more of Whistleblower of the Week after a quick message from one of our whistleblower friends. Don't go anywhere.
My name is Sharon Watkins. For better or worse, I am known as the Enron whistleblower, and I certainly have a heart for those going through anything that can be called blowing the whistle or speaking truth to power. I am here today to encourage every one of you to participate in making National Whistleblower Day permanent. You can do this by going to www.whistleblowersblog.org and joining notable whistleblowers like Jane Turner, Bunny Greenhouse, Aaron Restwick, Fred Whitehurst, and myself in taking action. We are urging our representatives, and you can too, urge your representatives and President Biden to sign an executive order recognizing whistleblowers on a permanent National Whistleblower Day. Again, that's www.whistleblowersblog.org. Together we can make this happen. Thank you.
So, Doctor, tell me, with the upcoming election and with the wars going on in the Middle East and so many things happening, how is Meta able to manipulate or utilize those situations to enrich themselves?
You know, information is currency on social media. And so we are seeing declines in adoption of Facebook, but Meta really sees Instagram as its most potent technology for reaching young users and then getting those young users to sign up other family members. But when it comes to content that you're talking about, like information that we need the facts, especially when it comes to very contentious wars where we're trying to assess, you know, what is the damage, what is the human toll, it is incumbent upon technology companies to be able to provide facts as a public service. I use this acronym TALK, Timely, Accurate, Local Knowledge. What we go to news for is that exact thing. We want it. We want timely, accurate, local knowledge. We want real talk. And what social media platforms provide, though, is some of that and a bunch of other static. And unfortunately, you have a company like Meta, where in Canada, they're trying to fill the gap in local news by addressing the dominance of these major platforms by saying these platforms have become the conduits between the public and information on the other side. And in between, what the platforms are able to do is really capture all of that advertising revenue, and they don't circulate it back out so that downstream of, you know, searching on Google, you might go to a local news outlet, but it's becoming less and less likely that advertisers are going to have their advertising so downstream. It makes more sense to put your advertising in line with where people are sourcing information, and then not just hoping that they click on the link that then goes to your ad. So advertising has changed so dramatically with social platforms that local news is not going to survive it. So in Canada, they proposed a online news act, which would require these mega corporations, these big tech companies, to pay into funds for local journalism. It was supposed to happen in proportion to the amount of links that were distributed on these platforms. However, there have been some negotiations now where Google is going to pay, or Alphabet, the parent company of Google, is going to pay $100 million into a fund for local journalism in Canada. Facebook decided they're just going to turn off the news in Canada. Yeah. I know. Astounding. Astounding betrayal of the public trust. So on Facebook, if you try to share, say, Canadian Broadcasting Corp, CBC, news from their URL, Facebook will break the URL and then, you know, essentially show you I'm sorry, we're not going to provide you with this link. And that's because they claim that the regulation is so overreaching. Now, research out of McGill University has shown that 5 million interactions with the news per day are lost because Facebook is breaking the links to news. And so that just shows you that a company like Facebook isn't interested in the greatest public good. And Facebook will say, well, only 3% of users' feeds are news articles anyway. And I think to myself, well, that's better than none. Mm-hmm. But also, this has to do with how Facebook's algorithms are designed.
Right.
They are designed to give what Facebook calls MSI, meaningful social interactions, which they believe come from news, come from family and friends, not the news. And so we are witnessing in real time a lesson for the U.S., which is that if you ask these companies to give you information that matters, like information about elections, like vetted information about the wars going on in Ukraine and Gaza right now, if you're in Canada, you get no reputable information. And that to me shows the power of these platforms, which is to say that no company should be in charge of making information infrastructure that doesn't have a pledge to informing the citizenry about important information that is crucial for the governance of their everyday lives. I think that that move by Facebook really just illustrates in the most jarring sense the difference between Meta and other corporations that are part of this field, this new information environment that we're working within. And remember, it's not that old, right? We're really only dealing with, you know, maybe the company's 20 years old or so, but we're really only dealing with this last 10 years of market dominance by these tech companies. And I think we can change the game entirely if we mandate public interest obligations for social media platforms.
But doctor, it's not going to change if a prestigious institution of higher learning like Harvard shuts up their whistleblowers or people who are trying to bring this knowledge to light, this truth to light. So do you equate what happened to you to the fact that Facebook gave them $500 million? And so they kind of were bought off? Or what other reason would it be to shut up a whistleblower when the whistleblower has such incredibly important information?
I think from my perspective, not to be too cynical here, but Harvard is the definition of the old boys club, you know, and what we're dealing with is a new power elite. These are people who've been highly educated that know how to create media campaigns and sustain them. So one of the things that I've been waiting for in terms of the attacks on me is just, you know, what's unassailable is the research. They can't go at the research, right? Mm-hmm. And right. So what happened to me is I was just a lowly staff member, just yep. like the 6,000 other academic staff at Harvard. And so the dean, you know, based on his personal relationships with people at Meta, felt some type of way about us using the moniker of Harvard to share the light with the world about what was happening inside of this company and how we knew what we knew and what we needed to research. Unfortunately, Harvard at this stage is a failing brand. You see it in the, you know, the missives of former President Larry Summers on X. Every couple of weeks, he seems to come out with a new diatribe about how he's no longer in power at Harvard and that there are new people in charge and that he doesn't want, you know, people like Claudine Gay at the helm if they're not going to toe the line on what they think is important. But, you know, when I look around that university and I think about the new president, Alan Garber, and his ties to pharmaceutical companies and how does a provost at a university become a millionaire, right? They do it because they're in line with and also networking in the background with companies either to turn a blind eye or turn a kind eye. to these corporations. And it's years and years and years of entrenchment that unfortunately, when I was at Harvard, I took copious notes and I kept a very close view on, you know, different companies and how they came into the Harvard fold and how they interacted with faculty. And I wasn't surprised that other institutes at Harvard were content to hold meetings of the Facebook Oversight Board on campus. Why should the Facebook Oversight Board be meeting on Harvard campus? Well, because Harvard sees it as a partner, not as a threat or a liability. And this only happens because there is funding and there's prestige to be had. But as we think about this new networked power elite, and we look at the sons and daughters of executives at these companies, it's not uncommon to see them on campus and in the classrooms and mentioning the work of their fathers and their mothers that are at these corporations, or in the Harvard Kennedy School, taking a leave from one of these companies in order to become more educated. But it's always strategic in Harvard in terms of how people become network and how these corporations want you to see them as being of broad public benefit. Most of my interactions with, or initial interactions with people in tech companies, that some of them have gone on to be lobbyists in Congress on behalf of these tech companies, happened at Harvard in the hallways and in office hours. And you know, in some respects, people do think, oh, well, these corporations, they're run by good people. These good people want good things for the world. But what we're realizing time and time again is that these companies don't have public obligations. They don't even have the same kind of ethics that, say, journalism or academia has in terms of what you should and shouldn't do with human subjects and how you should ensure the broadest public benefit based on your work. And I'm just, in many ways, you know, I'm a child of the generation of Rage Against the Machine, right? I'm not deluded by this idea that our institutions are uncorruptible and that academia is gonna save the day. But I am an idealist in my soul, and I wasn't going to just sit there and let this happen around me. I wasn't going to just sit there and say, oh, if you don't want me to research Facebook, I'll just turn my eye onto something else. Right. And I probably could have, and the heat probably would have died down. But because I kept the pan hot, you know, I got thrown into it.
Well, could we say you were constructively discharged?
I mean, yeah, that was one of the first things that my employment lawyer was saying to me, is this feels like constructive discharge.
Yes.
And part of it even dealt with, you know, talk about the isolation of whistleblowers.
Oh, yeah.
When I didn't get the hint that it was time to go, one of my managers started to interfere with my employee relationships and wanted one of my employees essentially to make a complaint about me.
Sure.
My employee herself is a very reputable human being and saw what was happening. And I'm very lucky that she told me immediately what was happening.
You are lucky.
And when I reported it to HR, they basically said, oh, well, this is unprofessional conduct. It's not retaliation. And I'm like, oh, okay. And it's not constructive discharge, but you're free to go, right? And I had a contract that they decided they weren't going to honor, even though at that point I hadn't gone public. I hadn't given any interviews. I followed their rules because I didn't, The hard part was, is I had this team of really smart, young, energetic people, and the Harvard PR machine was telling people publicly that we had till June of 2024 to wind down, which I think was a date specifically picked so that I would be not capable of doing election research. But also internally, they were giving my team very short contracts. So instead of renewing them for a year, everybody was on these 2 to 3 month at a time contracts, which basically diverted a lot of our energy into helping them get new positions elsewhere. Right. Yes. So in terms of constructive discharge, I believe that that's what was going on here. And that if the stakes weren't so personally high, I probably would have walked away before, you know, things got as bad as they did internally. But I felt a certain duty to my team. I felt a duty to the research to see it through. I felt a duty to the people who've supported my research over the years. And I also felt a duty to my field to try to see how far this would go, given the fact that, you know, I've never been academically sanctioned. I've never been a problem in terms of my research not meeting the requirements and excelling in my fields. But unfortunately, good work and good intentions don't pay the bills.
No, they do not. And unfortunately, that's a hard lesson whistleblowers learn. Did they come after you personally? I mean, in terms of spreading rumors about you, or one of the things, especially with female whistleblowers, is making, you know, subtle little digs about mental competency, or did they do any of that kind of shading on your reputation? Not stable, very common.
Yeah, one of my supervisors, I'll never forget how awful she was over email. Just incredible gaslighting, saying that yes. I had been exhibiting disturbing behavior.
Typical.
Because I was making jokes about being fired. And that I, in academia, it's not uncommon for you to get, you know, told that you're going to finish out your contract and it's time to move on. And if that was the agreement here, we'd have no problems, because by the end of it, I would have spent all my money. Harvard wouldn't have stolen or taken $3 million from me. Right. You know, me and my research, like, it would have been fine if that was the agreement. But internally, my supervisor, when she was sending me these emails, I just felt like, oh man, she's really trying to get me to pop off here. Like, she's trying to get me so in my own head that I start behaving irrationally, that I start, you know, not being able to control my emotions or whatnot. So I just asked her, I said, you know what, let's just keep this in email from here on out, because I know where this goes. You know, and I asked her to name the disturbing behavior, and she was like, oh, well, you told a colleague you were being fired. And I was like, listen, wound down, terminated, whatever you want to say, like, I have my words, I can use my words. And then that led to email or meeting and an email from the dean claiming that I wasn't allowed to talk to my colleagues or any donors about what was happening to me unless it was coordinated with the Shorenstein Center. And not long after that, the Harvard Crimson newspaper got a blind item from I don't know who that was taking aim at the dean. This is the Dean Elmendorf is the same man that rescinded a fellowship offer that was going out to Ken Roth, who was the head of Human Rights Watch. So the dean heard that there was an offer out to him, and he decided personally, I guess, that he was going to remove that offer to Ken Roth. And Ken Roth and another faculty member at the Harvard Kennedy School, Matthias Rees, basically did a media campaign to let the world know that the dean was acting on behalf of donors, because the dean had said to the faculty member, you can't have Ken Roth as a fellow, not that I care, but that people he cares about don't want this to happen. And I think it just goes to show that then when my story comes out in the Crimson, I remember being on the phone with the reporter crying, telling him not to publish the story because I'm still trying to negotiate contracts for my team. I'm not allowed to talk to anybody. So I'm in my head saying to him, like, listen, I can't talk to you, but please don't do this. But he did. He published the story. And I think that that's what hastened my exit. But it's hard because I don't know who wanted to take shots at Dean Elmendorf and saw my story as a convenient way to do that. Within my supervisors, these are people that I highly valued as friends and colleagues, and they were the ones that really landed the hatchets.
Yes. I just keep thinking, welcome to the world of whistleblowing. I mean, it's just brutal. And here you're trying to do the right thing. You're trying to do research, which is critically important in our society. Is the project over once they were able to run you out? Is the project still going or is it gone?
It's gone for now. They've taken all my intellectual property. They claim that because I was a staff member, they own all of my all of the IP that I've created. And that to me is very strange, because some of the IP they claim they own was for my book, which I have a separate contract for and did in off hours, but they claim that they own that. They claim that they own my very big research project located at mediamanipulation.org, and they basically put a tombstone disclaimer on it that it's not going to be updated. There's a lot of research that we were doing and in the process of that I don't know the fate of, because I don't know what would happen if I did keep pursuing it and publishing it. So that's something that my employment lawyers are going to have to try to negotiate with Harvard. It's really hard because Harvard is, you know, I pay. It costs me money to do this every time. And Harvard just seems to have unlimited resources.
Oh, yeah.
Where no person feels the pain of defense, you know, against this. And so in some respects, it's really, you know, trying to find someone within Harvard that is willing to do the right thing and get me my intellectual property back, as well as return the funding to donors so that we can continue the work. That being said, Boston University has been incredible in terms of getting me back up to speed, making sure that I have, you know, resources within the school to do some of the work that I want to do on networked incitement and election defense for 2024, and the work that I want to do around building a political internet observatory that archives what politicians post online. So I have some things that I'm going to do in the interim, but it does seem to me, you know, to be a real loss to have this research locked up in the coffers of Harvard, not to be seen really again. And I don't know how long they'll keep up mediamanipulation.org for. But nevertheless, you know, for from my personal vantage point, you know, it's really daunting to take on the biggest corporation in the world. Yes. And the biggest, well, Harvard is a corporation through and through, as is Meta. But in some ways, I'm lucky that some of the hits that I've taken from Harvard and the media are read by the public as being really snarky and pithy and saying that my research team lacked an intellectual lead when we were one of the main reasons why new faculty were even coming to the Shorenstein Center. You know, I have a PhD and they recruited me to Harvard to do this work.
Right.
But it was only when I focused on Meta that I became
enemy number one.
Exactly. And so
I have to ask you, Dr.
Academic freedom is something that the university has to commit itself to.
Right.
And what my case showed, the only interviews that Dean Elmendorf was willing to give were statements about me not having academic freedom because I was a staff member. What the academic freedom policy at Harvard says is very different, which is that the community of Harvard itself has academic freedom, including the students, including the academic staff, and that freedom must be protected. And I think that at elite institutions, we have allowed donors to overstep. I'm thinking here too of the way in which Nicole Hannah-Jones was run out of UNC, and it was a donor who didn't want her to have this prestigious chair and tenure at the university. And because this man had given $25 million, when he wasn't heard internally, he went to the press. And we have at Harvard very similar instances. If they don't get heard internally, they go to the press. And because Dean Elmendorf was willing to sort of lower the guillotine on me, Meta didn't have to go to the press. But to be sure, academic freedom only exists if the bureaucrats and the administrators in a university defend it.
So this is not just happening at Harvard. It's happening at almost all the universities.
It's happening at a lot of the bigger ones that are willing to take on contentious projects. Mm-hmm. Listen, I could pack up my bags tomorrow and do a participant observation of cruise ships and how people vacation, right? Like, you can study anything in academia. You really can. But I've dedicated my life to public service. And as a result, I choose projects that are consequential for public knowledge. And while I don't have the funding that I once had at this stage to do that, I have no doubt that in 5 years I'll be up and running and back fighting the way I want to be fighting. But until that time, I think we are going to have to look at university grants and donors. And I think it's well past time for universities to have gift givers sign a no influence clause.
Yes.
Which is to say that if they're giving a large donation to a university, they should not be allowed to influence the decisions at that university, especially when it comes to hiring. You know, and I think the consequences are dire if we turn our universities into PR wings of corporations.
I agree totally. And is it true? You mentioned that Facebook has set up a series of research engagements where Facebook, by contract, has the right to kill these projects before they get published. Is that true?
Yeah, so within some of the contracts that I've seen from colleagues, Facebook has a clause in there that says that they are entitled to pre-publication review, and that if they deem if any of the publication is revealing private information, that Facebook has the right to revoke publication. And what they mean by private information, now this is what's this is the detail that matters, is that it could be private information about users, or it could be private corporate information about the algorithm, about how the design of the system works. And I think my field of internet studies needs to get much better at adversarial methods. We need to get much better at not asking these companies for access, but devising ways to get access to data that allows us to do our auditing and our studies of these platforms, but doesn't require us to work with these companies. There were several important papers that came out in Nature and Science this year that I think really show the failure of these corporate academic partnerships, where Facebook was working with university researchers. The university researcher would ask a question. Facebook researchers would then go and look at the data and surface a summary of the data for the researcher. And you just had to take it on belief that the data they were giving you was the real data. And then this gets published in our highest status journals. And what we found out in that interaction is that if the researcher had worded their question differently, they would have been able to access different forms of data. And so it wasn't the case that Facebook was a true partner in research in that sense, but rather that they were still doing PR. And we cannot allow PR to drive research about these corporations. But nevertheless, I'm in the minority in my field in terms of not taking money or data from these corporations. But I'm, you know, much more in line with the ethics of old, which is that the imperative impropriety is impropriety. And so my research has to stay independent and on the outside. And I hope my researcher colleagues will understand the stakes here, which is that in 10 years' time, if we allow the market dominance of these tech platforms to continue, then a few people are going to decide the outcome of elections, because they're going to decide what kind of information you get. A few people are going to own the public debate on the proper use of technology in society, because they're going to be able to decide what kind of information you get. And politicians are going to have to maneuver in this very upsetting and turgid media environment. Or we become like Canada and you can't even get the news on social media.
Frightening, frightening. And I'll have to say, like most, the majority of whistleblowers, you possess integrity. So where are you headed? Are you in this fight for the duration?
I'm in it as long as my, you know, my bank account will allow. I think we're going to set up a legal defense fund and, you know, really try to ensure that I don't, you know, have to get a second mortgage on my house to do this. But if that's the cost, then that's the cost. You know, you only live one life, and I sure am going to die with dignity.
Good for you.
If anything, I might not have a Rolex, or, you know, I might be buried in my minivan, but it, I won't regret the time I spent doing this, knowing how odious these corporations are and how much of a awful precedent they set for the future of technology and innovation. You know, that part to me is also very, very scary. Is can you imagine a world in which our technology is owned by some of the most
soulless people.
I would say anti-intellectual
yes.
people who only see the propagation of wealth
yes.
and their products as the guiding light. The other thing I'll say is also is that social media has been in a real standstill over the last decade. There hasn't been a ton of innovation. Twitter's pretty much still Twitter. YouTube's pretty much still YouTube. Facebook's pretty much still Facebook. And when we allow tech giants to operate, we also stifle innovation. And innovation that could be good and useful for society gets bought up and shut down. And so it's my hope that our politicians see that technology can be a very important and progressive and supportive tool for society. But right now, we're in a lock where, you know, the technology itself doesn't work for most of our social institutions, political institutions, cultural institutions. And yet, it's the best we've got. And I think we can do better.
Well said. And, you know, in this whistleblower community, you are always welcome. Francis Haugen was at National Whistleblower Day this year.
Oh, and very so, cool.
Yes, it's in Washington, D.C. every July. And I hope we see you there because.
Count me in. I love a good
You are a whistleblower and you are part of this community now. And so for any support, we will help you. You certainly have a wide range of whistleblowers that I can put you in contact with. And I am just so proud of what you have done and the integrity you have shown. You are something else. You are special. So thank you very much. And, you know, part of our push is for making National Whistleblower Day permanent. And you certainly will be one of the stars, hopefully, this upcoming year.
Well, I'm happy to come to D.C. in July. It sounds like a party. So let's do it.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank I appreciate you. It.
I appreciate you.
Thank you for listening. And please don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe. If you want to read more whistleblower stories, go to www.whistleblowersblog.org. Music by Rachel Kilgore. Editing and booking by Anissa Shake and Victoria Thompson. And a special thanks to our sponsors, Whistleblower Network News. I think you'll find that it's just as hard to stand up tall as it was when you were. The truth is hard.